Reading number 3, A Child's Memory of Wartime England. Chapter 9, England, 1914-1918, My War Years. War! 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 Great Britain's at war! That is all my friends talked of when I arrived at school in England 2 days after the start of the autumn term. War meant no more than that, an exciting word.
Rose, tell us, what was it like? See a German? See any guns?
The boy wonder refugee from Belgium, I revelled as the centre of attention. Wide-eyed, my classmates swallowed my fancifully embroidered tales of whizzing bullets, cannon fire, and sabre-brandishing Uhlans. Just as suddenly, my days of glory ended. I was Rose the misfit, the new boy who couldn't play games, the boy with foreign ways, a wimp. I refused at first. Afternoon games are compulsory, the game's captain ordered, and I was forced to chase a ball bare-kneed even when it rained. Becoming a victim of a dozen flailing boots in a muddy field was no game as far as I was concerned.
In Bruges, I'd begin, I was the school champ at wall bounce. I once bounced,
the boys guffawed.
Bouncing ball champ, bouncing ball champ.
I didn't tell them I could roll a hoop all the way across the yard and back.
If Mrs. Smith bought 6 dozen apples, ate one on the way home, and gave away 1/10, how many...
Sitting at a wooden desk, ink on my fingers, struggling with pointless calculations, I was insulated from the war. In the greyness of my uniform and the depressive predictability of school routine, Miss Serple brought the only colour to our lives, yards and yards of colour.
For the war effort, for our brave fighting boys at the front.
Miss Serple got us knitting. After prep in the period known as free time, we doggedly one-planed, one-pearled, hideous mufflers from garish scraps of wool collected for us by the worthy women of the Women's Institute. Miss Serple filled hamper after hamper. We penciled messages and tied labels to each completed horror. Knitting was no longer sissy. Proud. We were proud of ourselves. I imagined my scarf around a soldier's neck as he slept shivering in a cold, cold trench, his grateful smile as he read,
"Come back safely, Rose," or "Your bravery is appreciated, Rose,"
another of my favourites. Miss Serple said personal messages would bring comfort to those brave boys. She'd pause, looking far over our heads, when she said,
"Those brave boys,"
twisting a shiny ring round and round on her left finger. Jones, who shared my desk, whispered her intended had left for France, obeyed Kitchener's poster, and signed up. The headmaster concluded morning prayers with selected readings from the London Times. "Lest we forget," he'd boom. Victorious battles won, territories conquered, and tales of bravery and sacrifice of the fallen remained as remote as a history lesson. But when a new batch of soldiers marched past the school gate, their stirring songs often interrupted our aged master in mid Amo, Amas, Amat, or whatever the lesson was. Losing concentration, thankful for the excuse, we craned our necks, hoping we'd glimpse the column marching along the road to Farnborough Station. Tramp, tramp, tramp. Those rhythmic steps, those immortal, sorrowful notes linger forever along that leafy lane. Goodbye to Piccadilly, goodbye Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. And so it was. A long, long way to go. Term time over, school broke up, but our home was gone. Home that first holiday became Number 5 Norfolk Road, a small flat in Cliftonville. The very first week an aerial torpedo whined overhead in the middle of the night, narrowly missed our chimney, and demolished Number 10, 5 doors down from us. Directly behind the defence lines dotting the coastal seafront, air raids and distant sounds of intermittent artillery fire were constant reminders of war. Lewis anti-aircraft guns rattled from concrete pillboxes, Big Bertha thrumped enormous shells from across the channel to mostly land harmlessly in council allotment gardens along the cabbages and cauliflowers. Long grey destroyers of the Dover Patrol battled ceaselessly offshore within plain sight of the seafront, with smoke pouring from their funnels. The Taubes, not wanting to carry live bombs back across the channel after their raids on London, rained them on Cliftonville, Margate, Lewes and Brighton, along the southern coast. Mother complained Cliftonville wasn't safe. Father retorted refugees could not be choosy. Mother snapped that all they had left were the remnants of his commuted pension and handouts from the Army's indigent fund. Father rounded, she'd just have to manage. But for us children, it was the seaside. We found ways to wiggle round the rows of barbed wire and concrete barricades angled over the beach. I remember my sisters and I running down the road to watch Mr. Pettiman the grocer harness shire horses as big as elephants to his three bathing machines, then us following as he trundled them onto the beach.
So as the ladies might change and have themselves a swim, keep themselves decent like, he'd say to us with a conspiratorial wink.
Barefooted in the sand, I'd glimpse the frilly-capped ladies, discreet in knee-length, short-sleeved bathing dresses, and watch them step from the machine's back door right into the icy Atlantic. Such squealing and splashing, I longed to join them. While civilians continued normal life as best they could, England's young men perished in the Flanders mud. When the neighbor's boy, Colin, could boast light fuzz on his upper lip, he signed up and was gone, never to return. Rule Britannia! Bound by the common spirit of war, strangers greeted one another out loud. Nothing shook stalwart British morale, not bombing raids, nights spent huddled in discomfort, not death, destruction, nor the shortage of food. No Hun will starve me, no sir, I heard the butcher tell his queue of customers. One time I waited in line with Mother to help carry home the allotted newsprint bundles of our weekly quarter pound of meat per person.
Any rabbit? Or could you perchance spare some lung, Mr. Jones?
Which Mother disguised as mock duck à l'orange. Rabbit and offal were also exempt from rationing, and chicken feet, crunching exaggeratedly, savouring each toe one by one, I so disgusted Eileen and Rita they refused to touch them and left seconds for Cathy Baby and me. Hun, Hun, Hun. I practiced the new word. 1915. It was a rare night we slept undisturbed. Heavy howitzers, rain shells, airships flew overhead. Whizzes, bangs, and explosions were the norm. Our warden became a familiar sight in his dark blue helmet and uniform, cycling determinedly up and down Norfolk Street. I'd call out, "Any chance of a raid tonight, Mr. McTaffy?"
"Don't you worry about them Huns, laddie. I got their number. Now off the street with you. Curfew in 10 minutes."
As searchlights swept brilliant beams across the night skies, Mr. McTaffy cycled down our street, booming through a megaphone,
"Everybody inside, clear the street, make for the cellars."
We rarely used ours, however hard I pleaded. Mother witheringly ignored me with a dismissive,
"Nasty damp place, we'll catch our deaths in there, Hugh." "Mother, we should go, Father said we must, please."
I'd run to the window, hoping to watch a real battle.
"Get away this minute, Hugh!"
And I was made to draw the velvet over the faintest chink. At the first sound of an approaching airplane, our landlady, Miss Poinder, burst through the front door of our flat, white, hysterically twittering,
"Oh, Mrs. Rose, Mrs. Rose, Lordy, Lordy, I don't want to die alone. May I presume?"
Mother's eyes widened, and to disguise the fear she'd never admit to, actually shouted,
"Under the table, children, this very minute, don't panic, now!"
Her trembling voice gave her away.
"Must we, Mother?"
I delayed as long as I dared. Following Rita and Eileen with Cathy Baby, I reluctantly crawled under the dining-room table, dragging in the two tartan rugs and the bicycle lamp Mother kept on the sideboard for emergency. Two strips of black ribbon glued with flour paste across the glass cut its light beam to a feeble sliver. "Come, come now, Mrs. Poynder," Mother soothed. "We'll pray together. No harm will come."
She and Mother fell to their knees, tight up against the table, shielding us with their thickly skirted bodies. We'd collapse in giggles, taking turns to peek from under the chenille table drape. Heads bowed and shrouded under makeshift veils of lace antimacassars, snatched from the headrests of the parlor armchairs, clasping their shaking hands piously together, the two of them moaned their pleas until the sky fell silent.
"We beseech thee, spare us. Not for us do we ask this favor, but for our innocent children."
Mrs. Poynder and Mother had recently got religion. Prayer was Mother's lifeline, her comfort. Father in London, God became her very help and succor. Each bedtime, as I knelt at Mother's knee, mouthing the "God bless so-and-so and make me a good boy" ritual, I was wondering about the German enemy's Christian boys. Would God bless them too? Did they pray for our defeat as we did for theirs? Would he side with them or choose us? It made no sense. The war followed us around however many times we moved, and we moved often, but special treats stick in my mind more than hardships, though how Mother scrimped the extra pennies for them I cannot imagine. "How would you like a special treat, children?" Counting out one precious coin for us older three. "Be off with you," she'd smile. Ticket in hand, I'd race to the seat closest to the orchestra pit of the local cinema and wait for the organist to appear. In a beam of floodlight, the theater organ rose mysteriously into view, wheezing tunes that filled the far corners of the auditorium with patriotic songs. Focused on the organist's bony fingers, I'd follow his hands and feet as they tickled the ivories, his hands dancing flamboyantly across the keys to make the most of his time in the spotlight. An aging fixture, he entertained the audience before each show, then accompanied the entire film. Galloping hooves when horses galloped, thunder when it thundered, high twinkling notes when the stars appeared, and so on. Even with my eyes tight shut, I saw the entire story in his music. I knew his formula. But before the feature, that it was the turn of us, the audience. An off-white screen unscrolled from above the stage, printed boldly with the words of the songs, and how we sang.
"Keep the home fires burning. Goodbye, goodbye. I wish you all a last goodbye. She's my lily of Laguna. She's my lily and my rose. It's you, Lily Marlene. It's you, Lily Marlene."
Marlene? Without understanding all the words, I knew them by heart. Suddenly hushed. The screen flickered and Metro Goldwyn Mayer's lion roared a great roar and jumped through the paper hoop as the credits rolled. Intolerance, Orphans of the Storm, and Scaramouche. I see the faces of the Gish sisters, Charlie Chaplin and long-forgotten others, Tom Mix, William Hart. Another of Mother's treats was to take us to a musical recital at Bobby's tea shop to eat crumpets and tea cakes. Three elderly females entertained us on two scratchy violins and an out-of-tune piano. Wrong notes and all, something inside me seesawed. I brimmed with joy. I crumpled with sadness. One very special day, Mother packed a small case and took my sisters and me to visit Father by train to celebrate some long-forgotten occasion. For the first time in my life, I saw Father take Mother's arm affectionately and beam fondly at her. In the middle of 1917, a Zeppelin exploded in flames over Potter's Bar. Our fortunes exploded too. Father's new job entailed raising and training the 10th Battalion of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders for the front. Father shook the mothballs out of his uniform, pinned on his ribbons, and splashed the bulk of his officer's salary on rent for a large Victorian house in Ripon, Yorkshire, in the north of England, and salaries for 3 well-trained servants, an orderly and a groom. Father in the money was a gentleman again. After Margate, Yorkshire was so quiet I couldn't sleep our first week there. No sirens, no searchlights or scurrying under the table, I forgot the war was on. 3 months in Ripon were the calm before the storm, the last time we lived together as a family.